Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello, welcome to The Gallery. Conrad Murray is an actor, writer, director, rapper, beatboxer, singer, teacher and theatre maker. Since 2008, he has been leading the Beatbox Academy at Battersea Arts Centre in London, which he had initially set up with Monique Duchesne, SK Shlomo and MC Zany as a weekly youth group for 12 to 21-year-olds. Murray's independent work includes autobiographical solo show Denmark, made in 2016, the two-hander No Milk for the Foxes, made with Paul Cree in 2015, and The High-Rise Estate of Mind, made in 2019 with Lady Kiki, Gambit Ace and Paul Cree. The key aspect of Conrad Murray's work as a whole is deep commitment to collaboration. In 2016, with the Beatbox Academy, he created an adaptation of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which has become a critical and box office hit and has toured to the Edinburgh Fringe in 2019 and Adelaide Festival in 2020. A TV version of the Beatbox Academy's Frankenstein is airing this autumn on the BBC Culture in Quarantine. Currently, Conrad Murray is also co-writing a book on hip-hop theatre with academic and writer Katie Bezik. In the conversation that follows, Conrad Murray talks to us about his early beginnings as an artist, his formative influences growing up on a council estate, and the trials and tribulations of finding success against all odds. This conversation took place on Zoom on the 29th of May 2020 during the COVID-19 lockdown in London.
The way we do this conversation is I like to retrace people's steps and go all the way back to what kind of formal training you might have had, how you integrated it, how you reacted against it, both in terms of theatre and performance making and music making, and what formative influences were important for you in terms of specifically music here, actually, but also any other formative influences that became significant for you in how you work and so on. So you grew up in Croydon, did you? Or that's where you live right now?
Near Croydon, yeah. Similar postcode, but I live in Mitcham.
So yeah, let's go back to the council estate where you grew up and how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, I lived on a few different council estates. So I guess like music is always kind of blaring out of other people's houses and out of their cars. So as well as hearing the music that was played at home, which was kind of my stepdad and my mum both listening to different kinds of music to each other. And then also hear a lot of mainly hip-hop, drum and bass and ragga on the estate, which was kind of like a bit dangerous to my parents. You know what I mean? I feel me and my brother, we played hip-hop tapes upstairs because it had swearing on. It felt like it was the most dangerous thing we were doing. I remember thinking, like, this is bad. Like, this is, like, the most naughtiest thing we could be doing. So it's weird now because it's just music. But honestly, it felt like a secret society upstairs in my room. My brother would get these tapes from his crazy friend from school and then we'd put them on. It's weird because some of those songs sound, the instrumentation sounds soft now because you're used to it. Mm-hmm. But I remember it sounded like really, the music sounded dangerous. And then also the things they were talking about, often like politics or drugs. It was like, wow, like, it was quite an education, to be honest. Like, I think I learned more about sex from music than I did from, you know, anyone at school.
What years were these, Rafi? And what were the artists that you were listening to and that were particularly influential?
Well, like, Tupac was, like, kind of the main hip-hop influence that I first listened to, really. But you know what? Before Tupac, there was Will Smith, but it wasn't even Will Smith to my parents was dangerous. Like, yeah. Boom shit in the room. It was like, what is all this you're listening to? It's noise. It's just noise. I remember thinking like I was letting them down because I liked it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm such a letdown. But then Tupac, which is a lot more savage, but this isn't really connected. But what I find funny is Tupac's favourite artist was Will Smith. Mm-hmm. And yet they're completely different, mm-hmm. which is kind of crazy. But then also DMX and Onyx and a group called Out There Brothers. They had commercial songs that was like, boom, 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 everybody see where you're, where you. So which the public knows. But on their album, it was like so explicit. It's unbelievable. So Onyx and DMX, if you listen to their lyrics, it's very kind of dark and like talks about demons and dark. And I mean, it's kind of like proper adolescence fair. Do you know what I mean? But at the time, it was like, this is like savage. And actually, it was new for its time, that kind of music. It was like 1995.
But in Denmark, when you demonstrate your skill of being able to reproduce sound by listening to records, presumably that your family had, it's a different type of...
Because my parents' music is more older music, so I also like different styles of music. So I like Elvis because my mom liked Elvis, and my stepdad, he likes R&B and soul music. So there's quite a mix there. So, but that song that I sing there is an Elvis song, because I was very good at copying people's voices and stuff, not just the sounds but the voices. And I would really study the records on the record player. I remember sitting there, just seeing the disc spinning, and then just copying for hours. I think. I don't know what kind of like concentration you have as a kid, but you can just do it for hours and hours and hours, and then do it again. You start it again, and then again. Yeah, it's great.
So obviously music was a big thing in your family anyway.
Kind of. I wouldn't say they're music fans. They liked it as much as just a normal working class family, and probably less slightly, because they'd kind of put it on. But it wouldn't be blaring out or a big thing. I'd just be like, I like this. Put it on, play it once, turn it off. But they listened to music in the car mainly. And then my stepdad would listen to music at home loud, which my mom didn't like.
And how did you discover theatre?
Me and my brother were very precocious. We talked quite early on. I guess it's probably the way that my parents spoke to us, to be honest. There was no mollycoddling, or it was just like, do this, shut up, you know what I mean? I remember I'd watch TV and see kid actors. And I remember saying to my mum, like, oh, what is that? So she said, it's an actress. I remember I went to school and said, when they said, what do you want to be when you're older? I was like, I want to be an actress. And then everyone was laughing. I'm thinking, what? Yeah, that's what my mum told me. But I just had this thing in my head that I like performing, because at parties and things like that, me and my brother would always be, I don't know, showing off. Maybe it would be singing or dancing. We would just like to perform. Also, I don't know, there was kind of like a, I guess a lot of working class people... It's kind of like you're either going to make it famous or you're going to be poor, isn't it? Like people have this thing in their mind of like which kids are going to, you might, if you're good at sport or you're going to be famous. The idea of like a career or working hard, everyone goes to school, but there's no rewards from that. Generationally, there's kind of a distrust of that's going to actually lead to anything, because we all went to school, but we're all the same. So I think it's kind of like, you know, you need to be a boxer, or you need to be a singer, or so any kind of precocious kind of attitude is like putting you forward. So I had this in my head, I wanted to be a performer or something like that. I didn't necessarily know about the theatre until I went to the Poker Theatre. Do you know the Poker Theatre?
Yes. Yeah.
So a school, well actually before that I'd gone to the theatre because my mom's a bus driver. There's like a, I don't know what it is, some sort of charity thing where they take some of the kids on trips, like the driver's kids. So they took us to see Dick Whittington at Wimbledon Theatre. I remember it was at the very back row, but it was pretty mind-blowing at the time. I just thought it was amazing. They used to take the bus driver's kids, like without our parents, it was just kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And exciting.
Yeah.
To watch shows on ice. So you would watch people ice skating. And apparently, it used to be quite a big thing. They'd be like, I really remember Snoopy on ice, and there'd be different things on ice. But I think what happened was that Disney took it over, so now everyone only knows it as Disney on ice. But before, it would be Dick Whittington on ice, or like, I don't know, Jack and the Beanstalk. It'd be lots of different stories, but as with everything, kind of Disney took it over, and it's probably a bit old-fashioned now. But also, that was theatrical. But the Poker Theatre was when I really thought, wow, this is like amazing, because you understand more. And we watched the story of the Diary of Anne Frank. It was an amazing story. Like, wow. I don't know, just this experience of seeing people in front of you telling the story, which is a real story, but they're real people. You know, it's just like mind-blowing. I want to do this as well, like, because the way it's making me feel, it's like, wow, like imagine being part of this. And I just remember just thinking about it all the time. And we did do drama at school, but it was different. It was off and on. But we did do some drama, which I enjoyed. But it was in English. They mainly spoke about drama. And I remember never forgetting when they talked about soliloquy and all these different terms, thinking, this is like, that means that's what they were doing in Anne Frank. So I'm lucky because school wasn't that important to me. And I had a bad time and I was bullied and the school was on my estate. It was shit. But I remember these things, and my social worker, who told me about the Brit School, and basically got me an interview and audition. I just so happened to just remembered all these things from English, but it was only because of Anne Frank. So I remember thinking it was probably like one of the best days of my life. And I was thinking, wow, like I'd remembered all these terms, remembered the play, but it was not in preparation for an interview. It was just that I just kept thinking about it. And I thought, man, like I'm so lucky that had happened, that experience, because there's no way I would have got in otherwise. A lot of the kids there, they had a lot of experience before they go there.
How old were you when you got into Brit school?
14.
Mm-hmm. So you did what? What's that stage of education then called? Like GCSEs or?
You start your GCSEs.
Yeah. And at Brit school, you kind of trained to be a performer, right? Is that what the education is? Yeah.
You choose different areas. So I choose drama because I wanted to be an actress. but actually, most people would, even when I started there at Brit school, everyone would always say, why didn't you choose music? Because everything you do is music. And even though you say you want to be an actor, because I was still young, I had limited language, I understand. But the thing is, people don't realize how elitist music is. Very elite. And you have to be very, very rich to do well in music. And even if you look at the pop charts, you know, Sam Smith, Ed Sheeran, these are children of millionaires. They may dress like us, they act down, but their parents are millionaires. And it's hard because people buy in these stories of, they hang around the pub like us and around the park, and it's like, it's all bullshit. I know this because I went to the same schools they go to. They're fucking rich. So by the time they go to somewhere like the Brit school is amazing because it does give, it has to give local kids a chance to get in, and it has to have a certain amount. But the first time I ever saw a piano was at Brit school. Would I have ever seen one if I didn't go there? Probably not. You know what I mean? But I got to touch one. Amazing experience. People don't think about how amazing that experience can be. It's just I got to see a fully stringed guitar in tune. Like, I would never had that experience. But the music strand, because of the way that you had the sorts of knowledge they expected you to have of music, that would have taken thousands and thousands of pounds of training. You know, I'd never had any music lessons. But the whole time I was there, all my friends were like, always. They kind of saw me as a music person other than drama, which for me was weird because I love music. But and even now, you sometimes feel like you're cheating. Music's my job and I do it, but there's always that sense of, and I know it's not true, but it's in the back of your mind that I've never studied music. I just love music. I can hear tonally, I can hear harmonies, and I love it. But it's this thing of like, you're the musician, you're the actor, you're this. And, you know, now I encourage people to break down those boundaries, but I know what it feels like when you feel like, oh, that's not what I do. These are the great ones. And they show you, this is the great pianist who's playing this piece that was written hundreds of years ago, and he's learned it, rare. And you're making and inventing, but somehow, you know, you're taught that, so that's not a valid skill. But actually, you know, it is a skill. But at the time, when people would say, oh, you know, shouldn't you just be on the music strand? I'd think, wow, that's wild. Why'd you keep saying that? Because just in my free time, I'd be on those pianos, mate, having fun with them, bashing them out, any instrument. I'd be like, I just wanted to have a go because it was there.
And how long were you at the Brit School for?
I was there for 2 years. So you can be there for 4 years. Then if you probably saw it in Denmark, but I was always in trouble. You know, I took in a gun and quite early on was suspended. But the teachers still liked me. They were actually, even though I was always in trouble, I had a good relationship with the teachers because they knew me more than the good kids. Because I was in the head's office all the time. My parents were always all the time. Like, but by the end, I was quite confused about what I wanted to do, I guess. And I just thought, I just want to get out. And I've already felt a lot older anyway. Because, you know, the kids that went there are quite mollycoddled and they talk about mummy and daddy and whatever. It's like, I don't talk to my mom and dad about what I'm doing here. Do you know what I mean? What? Do you know what I mean? What your mum thinks about what you're going to be doing, you talk to your mum about that. But that's because their parents are still supporting them. At 16, even now, you know, kids will be having conversations about college and university. And I never, ever had a conversation about that in my life. So I kind of wanted to go out and make money and thought that's what I needed to do. And to be honest, class-wise, that was probably better for me because another 2 years, because my 2 years there was different to those other kids' 2 years there. Because they had a support system for those 2 years. They had all sorts of shit going on staying there for those 2 years. Although it would have been brilliant, brilliant time. Well, it's not equal when you step out those 2 years. You're older. We might be the same age, but they have all those connections, family connections. They have all that money already. I wasn't thinking that way. I just knew I just needed to do my own thing. And I thought, at the time, I was like, yeah, I'm a big man. Yeah, I need to get up. I need to get out of this. And, you know, it was sad to leave my friends, but it was best for me because I got a job as a bus conductor. Buses is like the family. That's the family industry. I started buying music equipment straight away. So recording equipment, music. I spent every penny that I had and spent that time learning and doing. And actually, that was probably better for me. Risky. And I don't know what. And I think I'd be more scared to take that sort of risk now. To like say goodbye to this massive institution looking after me and be like, no, I'm gonna do it myself. But I'm glad that I was, you know, when you're young, you're just like so fiery and angry. I'm gonna do it myself. It was great because I learned how to multi-track and I had loads of interest from like the record industry and stuff like that. And again, now I think back and think, wow, this is crazy. Some of the things I was able to have access to, but I did it all myself from my bedroom in a council estate. It's mad. I look back and think, I don't know what I was doing.
So you were sort of making music that was and writing, presumably, that was in the vein of your interest in hip hop and
And other stuff. I was experimenting with guitars. I was mashing it up. I had a drum machine, but I'd also play guitar on it. Like it was like indie mixed with hip hop. I was just mashing stuff up. I remember going to studios and stuff, and people were like, "What the fuck? What is this?" And I remember the head of music at Brit School. I went back there for a careers meeting because. Back then, you'd go back and get a careers meeting with your teachers. So I'm thinking, it might be Brit School, but I'm going to go back. They need to help me out. But they were like, it's never going to work. You know, even though I'm mixed race, my dad's Indian, whatever, like we work. It was like, nah, rapping is not, England, that won't work. Playing guitars with rapping, that's not going to work. And there's loads of songs with guitars. But the thing is, maybe they're onto something because when it's a posh twat like Ed Sheeran, he's allowed to do some kind of false rapping over a guitar, isn't it? But when it's like people actually from council estates doing it, they want to limit you what you can do. Like, it's really depressing because they want to put you in a box. Like, it needs to be like this. So a lot of it was a bit before it's... You're not allowed to be that experimental. It needed to have been fully one thing or fully the other. But I was experimenting. I wasn't really worrying about it. I just thought, fuck you, do you know what I mean? I'm going to carry on. Oh,
never had no books in our house.
So this was, I presume, something like late 90s, early 2000s. That
late 90s, yeah.
Yeah. And what was the sort of technologies that you were using at the time? I know that in Denmark you use the loop pedal. You use your voice, obviously, as a primary thing when you work with the others. But what were the kinds of music-making technologies you were using at the time?
I started off with a four-track on tape. So I'd seen them at Brit School, actually. We used it a bit. But because music was my minor, drama was my major, we didn't get a lot of time with it. Well, actually, what I first did was I made my own four-track. So I connected two different tape machines. I would record on one and then play it back and then sing over that with the other one recording at the same time. And then play that and be singing with that's already recorded. And then that one's recording at the same time to layer, layer, layer. But what happens when you do that is it's a destructive kind of recording, because on each layer, the last instrument you recorded, as you re-record, it downgrades that layer, like it becomes less quality. But it gives it a certain quality because you're recording on tape, and there's something interesting. I mean, a lot of those old 60s and 70s recordings are done that way, that some of the earlier takes would have degraded when they actually, and the songs we're hearing. But it gives it a certain quality, and it was great to experiment. But what the four track did was, it's less destruction in the layers. But you still do it because you record 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you bounce those four down into one track, and then you can record another three over them, and you keep bouncing it down. I'm quite glad that I started that way, because it's good experience for understanding layering, understanding what is going on. Because now when you buy software, it does it all for you, but people don't actually know what is going on. Whereas now, if I'm using a digital audio workstation, I'm always aware of all the different processes that are actually happening. Now it's a little, you press one button and it's got a delay on it and it's doing all sorts of things. But that's not even your delay. You haven't even set it up. Before, you know, that would be a rack unit that's coming in as an insert into your machine, like loads of different things. But I think having the hands-on experience, because I was just as the technology was coming in. And I remember, because I was saving my money. I never had any friends. I didn't have, had an interest in girls, but it didn't have an interest in me. So there's this perfect alchemy of like having interest and being the geek is great, mate. At the time, it's a bit depressing. Do you know what I mean? If someone said to me like, hey, you could be hanging around with girls and doing, I would probably say yes. But now in retrospect, I'm like, I'm so glad that I was just doing whatever I wanted to do, because it gave me that intense focus. And I remember going into a music shop and buying all this stuff. And the guy said, because I had money, I was just saving, I had nothing to do. He was like, don't buy all of this stuff. Buy one computer, because it will do it all for you. But I said no, because it was very early on. And like, I was thinking, what? I thought, how the hell can that computer do everything? And at the time, it actually couldn't have done as much in depth as I wanted. It could do it all, but it would have sounded actually worse, in the same way that, you know, a CD or a tape's quite convenient, but vinyl actually has frequencies that we hear that it's more bassier, it's different. A computer's different, it's not better. And I think that's what you learn. The more you think about sound, is it's never better. Even like that destructive way of recording I was talking about, it's not better now, it's just different. Because when you hear 50 people singing at the same time, you're not hearing them all exactly the same at the same volume. Someone's standing at the back, someone's slightly to the back. So sound isn't equal anyway. It's not. There's not one equal way to hear it. But no, I started off on four tracks, and then I got an eight track, which was I'm trying to think, how come I got the eight track? Just meant I had more channels, less destructive, it was digital, but it was quite expensive. I'm wondering what happened. And not that it's that important to the story. But I was thinking, how did all of a sudden I afford that? I was hit by a car at some point, and I got compensation. When I was a bus conductor riding a bike, I got hit by a car, but the guy was arrested. It was a hit and run. He was arrested, and anyway, I got a conversation, so I had a little boost to my cash so I could get some more equipment. So I moved from a four track to an eight track, and again, I'm so glad on that journey, because I went straight to a computer, which again was so early, and you couldn't record with audio on a computer. It's just MIDI, and the audio was shit. Enjoying that journey of wow, I've now got eight tracks, like. Now it's unlimited. Not that they can, no one cares, but I'm like, that feeling of getting those extra tracks is such a great feeling. Yeah. Like recently I was at CPT with I got a Bluetooth keyboard. So I can move around the space. But also, it's not just a keyboard. I could trigger drum samples. I can trigger anything I could trigger on there. I'm there and I was like saying, this is amazing. It's really smart. Where is it? Anyway, so here somewhere. And I'm walking, because I'm thinking you could build these into the set and you could have people triggering sounds. Like, this is amazing. Like, and then the engineer on the desk was, I'm what? And I'm thinking, can you fucking see this? I'm over here playing ear, no wires, and it's triggering sounds. Anyway, I think that's kind of the epitome of, you know, if you don't experience that journey of the different kinds of equipment, you don't really get to respect it.
Right. That's really interesting. So what was your next step then?
So I went to Brit School, then I went to South Thames College. South Thames introduced me to BAC. And it was through South Thames and BAC I learned a lot more about the theatre world in a real sense than at Brit School, because Brit School will teach you about proscenium and arch when it comes to theatre, very old school. Whereas getting involved to BAC and through South Thames, actually giving us that knowledge with that access, I learned about people devising and creating.
How old were you when you were doing that, just to get my bearings in your life story?
I went to South Thames when I was 18.
Okay, and then that's when you discovered BAC, because they had a pre-existing relationship and you discovered devising.
But at BAC, in the youth theatre, it was quite mixed. People didn't do the theatre group because they wanted to act, which also blew my mind. Because I still had this thing that I would say, oh, I want to be an actor. But I knew that it didn't really fit what I was doing at all. I'm making music, I'm mashing it up, I'm thinking of many different ways to make performance. But I didn't have the language to know what I'm supposed to say I do. But there, they'd be like, oh, I'm playing around. I'm a performer, I'm an artist. And in the group, they'd be like, a bank. I remember one guy worked in a bank. I remember thinking, like, wow, I'm in the same session as someone who works in a bank. That's weird, that's mad. And a lot of these people that worked in the city, they would say, oh, I'm interested in being creative. I don't want to be an actor. I remember at first I was kind of angry. I thought, why are you wasting your time? And then I realized, wow, there's value in what they're doing. Like, this is actually really valuable. They're really tired and coming here for what reason? And then some of them have been to uni and they talk about uni. And I don't know what uni was. I don't know anyone that ever went to uni. I never heard anyone talking about uni. I'd heard the word on TV, but for me it was somewhere that where posh people went. And then I just had it, wow, like, I'm at the BAC, I know about theatre stuff like they do. I hang at the same place as a bank guy. Maybe I should go uni as well. I asked one of the teachers called Deirdre. She said to me, go to King's Uni because it's very practical. It's a very practical course and it's a very, very good course. That's how I went to there, because I really trusted her.
And how was that for you, being at uni? How did it form your kind of further development as an artist in either as a musician or as a performer?
I started the uni, but I did find it hard. I couldn't work out what time to go to my lectures. I didn't know the difference between a seminar and the lecturer, and I couldn't work it out, because I never, even though it sounds really stupid, honestly, 90% of the people there had heard of these things before. Their parents would have gone or a friend had gone, and it was like, I can't even access the words to get in the room, let alone like start thinking about what I'm learning. So I deferred, and then I went back 2 years later, and in those 2 years I carried on making music. I carried on experimenting. Then I was strongly experimenting in those 2 years with theatre and music, mixing up at BAC. Very practically, you know, I was actually creating more of a buzz about what I was doing. And I was starting to say that what I was making, like, I'd already thought this, but at Brit School, I'd always say, I want to make hip-hop theatre. I want to mash both of those forms up. Because although I'm learning about all this stuff from the past, none of it speaks for me. And it doesn't speak to me. Even though, you know, I'm just as excited learning about how Doll's House, you know, really pushed feminism. I thought it was amazing. I loved learning about that. I thought it was great. But at the same time, I thought it's great. But even the people that made the writers of these plays, they're not from the same background as me. I don't even fit into that world now. Like, who's going to let me, like, tell my stories? You know what I mean? Like, and how is that ever going to happen? Because all these stories represent the same people. And they're the best in their class, but they don't represent everyone. In those 2 years, I was getting much more practical, but I realized that the more I met people at BAC, I realized that the people that, even the devisors and stuff who'd done really well, they had gone to uni or they had gone drama school. They had their knowledge of being able to connect concepts was really strong. And like, again, I probably didn't have this formed in my mind at the time, but I just intuited that you possibly need to understand where this stuff is coming from. It's easier to start making connections and putting it together. other than just pure rage, because at the time everything was just like pure rage. I must be the best, and this must be the most amazing thing you've ever heard. I quite enjoyed being like that, but I don't know, something just told me that I needed to work out where all this is coming from, because everything that I was saying and doing wasn't original. Obviously, I'd watched films and I'd watched other people's work, and although it was my original voice, it really had come from other voices. Everything comes from somewhere. That obviously this is cliche or whatever, but I didn't know that. You know what I mean? It was the first time in the universe I had realized had these thoughts. So it was the first time again. And then going to uni, I remember Trish, I don't know if you know Trish Reed. I remember yes. On my first week, some people are taken out and because they offer you these extra special lessons in the library for people that may be a bit behind. And like, it's hard because at BAC, I was killing it. Like, I had the head of East 15, like people offered me to join their theatre companies. I'd worked with Complicité, a lot of people I'd worked with that were on the textbooks that we were learning from. I'd met the people already and worked with them, but I didn't know the language. I just practically could work. And I remember we had a list of words, and one I remember clearly that I remember it was the word protagonist. And I said, what does that mean? And I didn't know what it meant. And now it's really so embarrassing, but it's because that was how lacking, you know, and my knowledge was. I'd done all this theatre and performance, so it kind of dawned on me that there's loads of stuff I don't know. And it's so good to have that realization, because I've got a lot of friends who don't know what they don't know. And a lot of my friends I went to school with on my estate, I'm not lying, are dead or in jail or homeless. That's very true. And I feel like, you know, they never had the opportunities to have to learn these things. Because it can be frustrating. Like, you don't always have all the knowledge that you need to get on.
Why do you think you were getting this sort of access that maybe wasn't available to those other people you knew on your estate?
Our luck, basically. Luck. I think that my brother, we grew up from the same household, same problems. But because, put it bluntly, because my abuse towards me was stronger than his, even though his to most people would be very tragic, I had a lot more therapy. As an adult, I have a much better time than him because I had more abuse. So some of the kids in the estate, they might have been just as poor. They might have had a social worker, but they might not have had one. Again, I was lucky to have a social worker meant that actually there was next levels of abuse at home. So it was luck, but it was a strange kind of luck. Because yes. I had a social worker that was able to, and who knows, like, because I had a social worker, I may have been more eligible to get into the Brit school, basically. Like, I may have been more eligible, which is fine. You know, not I deserved the opportunity, but I was given the opportunity. But I wouldn't, you know, be able to do the application form or do all those things like that. So, like, what was strange is, like, everyone had the same levels of deprivation, but just certain types of deprivation can sometimes give you access to certain chances. Even on my estate where I lived, me and my brother would use the youth centre on there. But my sister is my stepsister. She's got blonde hair, blue eyes. We've got different dads. My dad's Indian. But she wasn't allowed to use the youth centre because the quota of white people was too high. But we lived in the same house. So sometimes there are quite complicated things which allow people access to, even though you're going through exactly the same levels of deprivation. But sometimes it's just different kinds.
Yes.
So it's luck. It's luck. But it's not just luck, it is the system as well.
Interesting.
But obviously, I was ready to accept these opportunities. But again, it can be easy for me to say, I was listening to music and I love music and to create this narrative. But, you know, I'm fully aware that there'll be people that also had the same thing but never really got that chance. And I think that really, I almost feel like the guilty one that I was given. So now it's like my duty. Yes. You know, with the Beatbox Academy and like even through Denmark, I always create other performances for people to just open up my show and after, you know, because it's kind of like I was lucky. I'm a teacher, you know, I worked at schools. I know actually to spend extra time with a student means that you're knackered and tired and you have to give up your lunchtime or you have to give up after school. So yeah. All those teachers, social workers, lecturers who met me, because I would bug them, all those extra times wasn't easy. The system isn't built for that. They don't have to do that. That's not their job. So I was lucky and also, like, I don't know what it is, ready to get some of the guidance and mentoring that they were able to give. I guess, you know, obviously it's very complex.
Yes.
But, you know, there's a kid that I walk past, you know, he's a grown man now. at Clapham Junction Station. There's a lot of homeless people there. And I kind of hate it when I see him because we went to school together and he's homeless. If I catch his eye, I know I'm going to have to give him a tenner. Do you know what I mean? Because we lived on the same estate. We went to exactly the same schools, apart from he never went to Brit school. But he'll say, remember, I was a singer, bruv. I was a singer. I used to do dancing as well. Remember my artwork, bruv? You said it was sick. And it's like, yeah, it was. It was absolutely brilliant. But I don't know, you know, it's hard, man. It's hard. And even when I went to Brit school, I still went home to the estate and I still had people being like, you're gay. Or like, oh, help me out, bro. Help me get in there. And it's like, what can I do? What can I do? I got robbed on my doorstep coming home because it was like, you're the one that's made it out. There was nothing I could do. You know what I mean? I think just feeling being listened to and understood is amazing. Whilst I was in my first year, the show that I made at the uni, by my second year, had toured it had a run at White Bear Theatre that they paid for, so we didn't take box office. They paid ahead for the show. That's rare. I didn't know. Now I know. Wow, that's quite big. The Cetra Club in Camden, they paid us to put the show on. That I made at uni in my first year. And then we did a 3-week run at Battersea Arts Centre in my second year, which is crazy. So like, I'm like, Kingston Uni was great for that because I made the show there. Do you know what I mean? Like,
what was that show called?
It was called Hitler Wrote 20 Pop Songs. And I wanted it to be a political hip-hop show. And Trish came to see the show. And so did Alex Mermakades. But the other lecturers, not only did they not come, but they complained about it. They were really angry. I understand for them. They hadn't seen anything like it in a way that, like, we're used to hustling. We used to, like, you make a song, you put on a mix that you're trying to sell it. You're trying to, and it's like, there some of the lecturers were thought that we were doing it to be rude, but it was like, but we're getting people to come to the uni. We're getting people excited about theatre. I'm going to other people's halls and they're putting posters up of our show. Like, and all of your students are in the show. And we're getting loads of people outside of uni come. And they were like, you're not supposed, because we were publicly advertising the show, but they're like, we're still in your first year. The uni doesn't vouch for this show. It's just yours that you've made it here. And you're advertising it as a public performance, which you're not supposed to do at a uni. And you put posters everywhere. But it wasn't, we didn't think we were being rude. I actually thought I was helping. We thought we were changing. Of course we did. We were young and we thought that we were changing the world. Like, we thought that this is going to be the best experience of your life. And we want to put posts everywhere and share the experience with everyone. We thought we were just, aren't we doing the right thing? Because the people doing you're telling me I'm wrong, but the people doing the wrong thing where I live are stabbing people, are selling drugs and hurting people.
When you say we, was this a company that you formed when you were at university? And tell us a little bit more about this show that was so controversial.
It was called Hitler Wrote 20 Pop Songs. So it's a bizarre title. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be absurd. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to challenge the politics of the day, because the thing that some of the lecturers were angry about, and reviewers and people at BAC even, but they still put the show on because we were rapping. It was completely different. There was no rap scene in the UK. Dizzy Rascal wasn't out yet. There wasn't UK rappers in the charts, let alone in experimental theatre. But the thing is, at the time, what we saw was a Tony Blair's government was a racist, white, right-wing government. Like, they may have been Labour, but they were racist. The people that they were killing were the same colour as my family. Super far right-wing racist government. They made universities all of a sudden have to charge to go to university, which before they were free. And the country in and of itself, people were getting, you could get, like, there were lots of bans on hoodies. You couldn't wear a hoodie and go into a shopping centre. Well, why not? Like, what if it's cold? And also, these are just clothes. It's how we dress ourselves. It felt like it was becoming really draconian. Again, it was partly the age that we were at. People are young and they feel like everything's against, you know, your ideas. But it's partly embedded in truth that the Tony Blair was far right-wing government and we now have another far right-wing Labour Party. And in it, we were rapping and talking about the country. But what we'd also do is there was lots of parts in the show that were really funny, but they may have been racist, but they were funny parts. Because the whole company was ethnic minority. But the audiences we played to were white. So people would be laughing and loving it. And there was always this... What we're trying to do is play with this element of, like, you know, you're laughing at this. Which are you agreeing with? And we were showing abuse to ethnic minorities on stage. But we were loving it too. We were acting like we were loving it. But the audiences were genuinely loving it. But I don't know if they ever... I don't think they ever really wanted to critique the work on what we were doing. I thought that it was a lot cleverer than what they really understood. But people couldn't get over the fact, including I never understood that at the time, and now I'm fully aware that the newspapers are super political. So The Guardian is not going to give you a good rating if you're criticizing the Labour Party, even if the work is like what it is. They're not going to do it. And the same with all the other papers, unfortunately. But also venues, like we had support from the venue, but some of the lecturers at uni, they were very angry because historically, I guess they had felt like they'd fought for a Labour Party for all those years and they'd finally had it. But we didn't know about this. All I knew is I was growing up with a right-wing government who was murdering lots of brown people in super high quantities. That also should be judged as well. But again, the rap and stuff. So the stage reviewed the show. They gave us no stars. They said that it was animalistic, that they couldn't describe what it was. They couldn't describe what it was. How dare BAC put it on? But what's interesting about that is it was the head reviewer, Shenton, who said this. He said, by the time the show's any good, our careers would be over. Which is disgusting. We were still at uni when the show was doing a off West End run. Some of the people in the cast were 20 and 19 years old. Now, for middle class people, they will say, oh, 19, 20, you're an adult. Mate, look, I've got people who are 30 on a council estate. Their cultural experiences, they're still hanging around kicking beer cans on the wall. They ain't got the same sort of experiences. Like, there's a lot of class issues when it comes to like the way that people understand. Because they don't understand what you're trying to say. It's not that you don't understand them. And the show was also banned. So the show got banned by whom? By the Advertising Standards Agency. So again, because we was at uni at the time, mm-hmm. I really wanted the lecturers to like the show because like everyone else, you want to please your lecturers. And I couldn't understand why, apart from Trish, they were so angry. Because I'm in this Evening Standard and they're writing about the work, not even just reviews, they're complaining about it. But I just fucking spent a whole year learning about Ibsen getting banned, these people getting forced to change their endings of their shows, all these other things. So what? So I'm spending all of my evenings doing the same shit, what I'm thinking in my own style, completely for, and then when we do it, you refuse to watch it. So it's a strange old journey. So BAC said I should apologize because the name of the company was Theatre de Cunt. So there was loads of reasons why they were banned. It's frustrating that we were forced to apologize. But BAC did stand with David Jubb wrote a 2-page article in defense of my company and the show. And I'll always be so grateful for that because to me, he was like a real serious person defending us. And I was a bus conductor for years and I was at uni. I was older than all of my friends at uni. So I also felt like, you know, only a few years older, but I'd got them into a show that was bad, that all sorts of shit. And like, everyone was a bit confused. Like, what is happening? But I didn't know what was happening either. I mean, to be honest, I was like, well, this is a bit of a whirlwind.
Click, click, clack, snap, snap. Chat, these screens are weapons, but you really shouldn't post that. We use devices as shields, we wield them over others' lives, validated by shares and likes. Click, click, seeming connected is more important than being connected. Sign in, sign on, so I don't feel neglected. Ain't got a BPC on my PC, you can't touch me. I'm protected by anonymity.
We are Generation Anonymous.
Click, click.
We are Generation Anonymous.
Click, click.
We are Generation Anonymous.
Click, click.
Click, click. Click,
click. Click, click. Clack, snap, snap. Chat, these screens are weapons, but you really shouldn't post that. We use devices as shields as we wield them over others' lives. Validated by shares and likes. Everybody's trying to trace their roots, just look at the youth. You can see the sad, sad truth. They're stuck inside personal prisons, living their life through screens no bigger than 5.5. Trading sunshine for online anytime. A whole generation unwilling to go outside. A whole generation unwilling to go outside. Click, click, clack, snap, snap. Chat, these screens are weapons, but you really shouldn't post that. We use devices as shields, we wield them over others' lives. Validated by shares and likes. Click, click, clack, snap, snap. Chat, these screens are weapons, but you really shouldn't post that. We use devices as shields, we wield them over others' lives. Validated by shares and likes.
So then you set up a beatbox academy at Battersea Arts.
Beatbox Academy, yeah.
Was that straight after graduating?
No, after graduating, I was asked to lead the youth theatre at BAC with one of the members of TDC, Monique. We led that, and I guess, again, it was like very hip-hop orientated and what we were doing. and BAC met up a beatboxer called Slowmo, and they were like, do you want to be part of this new thing? And then it was like, yeah, okay, let's give it a go. And it worked well because it's all hip hop culture. It makes sense. And then we started doing the Beatbox Academy, and then it kind of, you know, when it started evolving. From the second it started, it was one thing. It was changing straight away.
How did it work? Was it like a once a week sort of place for people to meet? Yeah.
Yes, every Saturday, and I'm not sure how long it was. Maybe it was two years or something like that. But it was, you know, funded for different terms.
And so Frankenstein, the piece that has become such a huge success, that it's been to, like, it's been around the world now already. It's been to Edinburgh, it's been to Adelaide, it's going to the BBC.
We're going to Sydney Opera House.
Oh, wow, you're going back to Australia. It was made in which year? When was it finished?
It started in 2016, and it was finished in, it's hard to say really, because it never feels finished, but I guess 2018.
Okay.
Finished.
How did you come up with this idea? Maybe one bit that we skipped in your journey is that you also trained as a teacher after Kingston, right?
Oh, yeah. So whilst running the Beatbox Academy, I needed more money. And I was Liz, the producer. Often when I would go into schools, teachers would always say, oh, you should be a teacher. Stupid me. You know, you go into a school doing beatboxing and rapping, and although it's once a week, the academy, the outreach could be sometimes every day. And I think, wow, when I go into schools, they love me. And I do remember one teacher said to me, and he looked knackered. He was like, yeah, they love you now, but if you worked here every day, it'd be a different story. And I remember thinking, wow, like, and I actually did think, like, oh, it's such a challenge. And I actually ended up working as a teacher at that school because Liz, I was broke, and I said, I'm desperate for money. There was no money at BAC going around. And she said, there is this one thing where they pay you to train as a teacher. And it was the last year that was ever done. So you don't get paid to train anymore. But I applied and I did it for 1 year. But at the same time, I still run the academy. So I was so tired because in the evening, I was still running the academy. But what was great is that the kids from the secondary school started going to the workshops of the academy. And it was great. And it was because the South London school. So like it was good for some things like that. It was great. And it was good to get the experience of training to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. It was very hard.
So then you decided to make Frankenstein with this group of young people. How did that idea come about, and how did you approach this project with them?
Well, it came about because initially when I was working with the academy, I would always be pushing, this show should be a big show. We need to make a big show. And each term, I think because of funding and because of new producers coming in, you know, something you just made and you want to keep working on it, everyone wants you to make something new. But there's no progress. So it's this new. And it's very, very frustrating. There's loads of reasons for it. But I made Denmark and went on tour with it. But then I had an idea that I wanted to take the Beatbox Academy on tour with me. Not all of them, but what we could afford to do curtain raisers and workshops whilst on tour. And that was really cool. But also I had an ulterior motive, is that I wanted to try and convince those places to then take a Beatbox Academy show. But one thing they would say to me is, we love the Academy. We come to see everyone. It's great. But what's the show? Maybe you need to make something like Denmark, because Denmark is clearly Hamlet, an allusion to Hamlet. Think about that, because that works. It's very easy to understand that. And I already wrote Denmark before it was called Denmark, and I wrote half of it before I even made those connections.
Yeah, let's talk about Denmark a bit more before we come back to Frankenstein. So this is kind of like an autobiographical solo show. And it came out at what time? What was the year when you kind of released it as then?
2013, I first did a scratch. But when it first came out as Denmark in 2016.
And then you toured it for a while. How did you come about with this idea of actually telling your life story through referencing of Hamlet?
Because I wanted to make a story about how the events in your life, do they mark you? Are you marked by them or not? And the initial name for the show was just going to be like Marked, right? And I was writing these things, and it was like, are we, to what degree are we marked by these things? And then I was reading a book which talked about Hamlet. So I started looking at Hamlet, and I realized, wow, like, I remember a teacher at school gave me a copy of Hamlet. A brand new copy. hold on. There's loads of stuff in Hamlet about questioning, about, you know, is it good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Hold on, wait, this is exactly what I've been trying to say. Like, and again, it might have just been already in my subconscious and I was looking for it. And then I thought, marked, why don't I call it Denmarked? Because that's the effect that the whole thing leaves on you is, which one is it? Is it the thinking? Because I don't think it's final. It's, I do think we all left with, like, is it totally true? And initially, when I had the idea of mixing Shakespeare with it, I so felt like it worked as a concept. But at the same time, I'm not good at saying Shakespeare at all. And I knew that BAC so liked the kind of street urban aspect of the show, how it was, and producers and people would like that, that me then merging it with Shakespeare was going to be quite strange. It's not what they expect from me. A bit like when I was saying I was mixing drum machines with guitars and people were like, this ain't going to work. It actually slightly felt like that again, because it was like, we really like what we've seen before. Why have you now got to do this? But I really felt, and I still feel like it's a strong concept. But you know what? Even if it means something to me, that's why. So why that links to Frankenstein is because people would say to me, producers, why don't I do something like that with the Beatbox Academy? Why don't you take something? Because it's easier for us to put that on, because it's very hard for us to sell to our audiences. Because I was performing in theatres and also performing on council estates. And producers said, why don't you just think of a story? Is there something you can take and do the same sort of thing? Where it's actually personal lyrics, but it's around a framework of another show. I just thought that the experience of going to all these different places would be so amazing for all those young people, because it was amazing for me. Yeah. And I thought, well, like, I've never done this and I'm a lot older than them. They need to, imagine they need to have this now. Like, what can we do as a conduit to them, to also making a great show, but also changing their lives?
Amazing.
Which is important. Yeah. So then when Lara, the producer, said, let's think of a show, let's do it then. And she said, Frankenstein. And then she started to say other shows. But then once she said it, and I was like, and then she was like, no, we need to like brainstorm. And I was like, hold on, Frankenstein's 200 years old. It was written by Mary Shelley when she was 18. In 1818, Tyler's 18. Like, hold on. It's a feminist book, basically. Our main writers, although it's the boys doing the beat, are the girls that write the lyrics. Let's do it. And then she was like, no, I just said it now. I was like, no, we don't need to think about it. That's it. Let's do it. And it just started from there, really. And then we started, we encouraged them to read the book, which all of them wouldn't do. some of them did, only I think one or two. And then we watched the films together. And then what we did was, I would say, like, write down words and sentences that really stick out, and themes, the things that you think mean something to you. And that's kind of the first thing we did as a source of putting out themes and stories. So, like, you know, it's funny because people would pull out stuff that would seem really connected to them. Like Tyler, you know, he picked out, like, the genius. But, like, you know, he kind of secretly sees himself as a genius. And he, from immediately when we said about the show, he was like, I'm going to be the main character. That's the first thing he said. But, and you don't know Tyler, but he was like, we had a much bigger ensemble at the time, about 30 kids. And only a third of them were going to be in the show. Tyler, I don't know how Tyler made it into that group. So the what was funny is when he was, I do know how, basically he was allowed to go in as long as he kept going to the training sessions, because all the other kids wanted him in there. But he's very shy and very, just super shy, and lots of other, shy about everything. But so it's weird, because, like, I want to be the main character. I'm the main character. And then when he's looking at the script, he's like, genius, misunderstood genius. And it's like, people find, I mean, I don't know, this is just me just, you know, psychoanalyzing the whole situation, but it just felt like you could see the links between the things they were finding. And some of the cast who made the show, who aren't in the show in the end, because they had lots of other problems, the things they were picking out were problems about that they were finding with a monster, about race, this is about, or like people not understanding them. And they were not linking it to themselves, but you can see that people are drawn to those things that are really coming from themselves. It's that whole thing of, like, you know, it doesn't matter what you're writing, fiction, doesn't matter what it is, it's all autobiographical at the end.
Oh my god, he's so hideous, looking at him makes my gut so bilious. He's got this amphibious stickiness, makes me wanna be sick.
Get a new plastic surgeon, boy, cause it's clear you have been stitched. Your face so freaking ugly, looks like a bug had sex with a witch. If I was your mum, I wish at birth you had been switched. The only way you would look good is lying dead in a ditch. What's up, lad? You're thick in your head. Can't understand a word I say. It's your sister, your mother. You're looking red. You never get a gal in all your bed.
Blood, what's wrong with your face? Your eyes, your nose all over the place. Your teeth so crooked you need a brace. You are a disgrace to the human race.
Oh my god, they're so hideous. Looking at them makes my gut so bilious. She's got this amphibious stickiness. Makes me wanna be sick.
Mom! Mom, calm down! There are more plastic bags under the sink.
Hashtag hideous. Your hashtag hideous. Their hashtag hideous. Your hashtag hideous.
Stay away, you freaking zombie. Don't dare touch my Abercrombie. You'll make it dirty, you so swampy. Smelling like you live on the streets. Oi, hobo, you're a no-no. Friendless, penniless, Quasimodo. You look like you made your home on the road, though. You're not welcome here.
Oh my god, they're so hideous. Looking at them makes my gut so bilious. They've got this amphibious stickiness. Makes me wanna be sick. Oh my god, you're so hideous. Looking at her makes my gut so bilious. They've got this amphibious stickiness. Makes me wanna be sick.
What was interesting about it was the way, well, several things really. One was this frame of doing rap battles at the start and at the end of the show, which is a very particular way of engaging the audience. It's kind of probably within the tradition of hip hop as well. And then there is this other element, which is like the way in which you approached that adaptation always seemed very sophisticated to me because of the way in which you read the script with a view to making the sounds of the language come to life, like the sounds of the writing come to life, like because that was the main means of expression of you as a company. That you gave us these, like at the beginning, you give us the sound effects of, you know, where we are in a way, which was quite interesting. And then, of course, you know, you'd pick out the themes and you break down the narrative of the book and just riff on different aspects of it. So,
but the tonally, the emotions or the sounds of the words and stuff, that would be, we would say, like, without words, create a soundscape. So create the mood of those feelings now, which is a, you know, very kind of abstract way to do it, but also somehow makes total sense, isn't it?
Did you keep developing it like live in front of the audience, or did you only kind of put it in front of the audience when you had the main bulk of the show?
No, we kept developing it, so it changed quite a lot. So so there were stages that was more narrative led. We did a performance of it without microphones, so there were lots of different stages, which definitely helped. But I would say that the feedback we had from every stage was always, this is absolutely amazing. Because one thing I feel like from outside sources, and it's very frustrating, is that the kids will now say, oh, remember back then when we were shit? Because they will hear adults say, oh, that you were shit then. Or, oh, it was really poor then. Because people that are involved now love to say that before they were there, nothing existed. But this always, everything always exists. We're just finding it again. All sounds are there, they exist. So it's very frustrating, and I hate people that are not or sensitive or understand our medium and platform. The fact we're dealing with young minds being around and saying frivolous remarks like that is very frustrating, because all of those incarnations were just as good as the others. They were just a different part of the journey, and they're just as valid. Like the part in Denmark when I rapped the Shakespeare, to be honest, when I think about it, I think it might have been better there. But at the end of the day, it's not better or good. Nothing's good or bad. Think it makes it so.
What do you think is the secret of its success? How come it's worked so well on the audiences in every incarnation?
I think understanding the journey of the show is the curtain raisers, the people that start, and the part of the beginning, so the audience get involved, makes them slightly understand this journey that we can all make sound. Like, a lot of the audience come out saying, I want to beatbox, I want to do it. And it's not that I want them to beat bots to join the academy. I just want them to understand it's all here. Like, all of this is all here for all of us. You know, maybe that sounds trite, but it's just important. You know, it's such a shared experience. I think that along the way, nothing to do with me, there were people that were trying to make it about this excellence part, about just the part in the middle, and which would have been so redundant. You know, there were people that didn't want to do the curtain raise, didn't want to do the battles. And I bring this up not to add any negativity to the conversation, but that just blows my mind. It's like, what, I don't understand why I had to fight for something that's a fundamental part of the practice of what we're doing. But again, when what you're dealing with is a street art form, and that is what you are doing, again, I can't complain because everything's been received well. And like, and I think it is because of that experience, but it hasn't been about having to argue and shout and tears and be very angry. And it kind of, you know, that some of the pieces of rage from the estate or being at uni or, you know, some is I haven't left really, even though it can seem like this is just a show with kids. It's not. All shows are with kids. We're all fucking grown up kids. It's all the same. I think that the fact that they're quite young has made it received really well, but I would hate that to be too much the thing, because I don't like the fetishization of youth. I think it's horrible and gross. I would love to make the same show with people that just want to beatbox who are 60 years old, because we live longer and we're still emerging at 60. I hope that is the message, that it's not just that you're young, it's that because the people at the start are very young and the people in the middle are older. I'm hoping that then the people who are older are like, well, that could also be me as well. I try and bring the audience, I'm not sure what night you were there, but now I kind of always do it now, the audience get involved in the circle jam as well, because it's like we're all part of this circle, we're all part of this journey. The excellence of the show part is meaningless. It's about the whole philosophy about the art form. And lots of beautiful people around, people like Trish, Liz Morton, the producer, Lara. There are some people that you have to work with along the way that can be, I would say, offensive the way that they talk to you and they try and talk to you, because they wouldn't do it to anyone else. It's not only because of the class of the work or where it comes from. It's something to do with music and sound as well. There's a hierarchy about it, about who gets to say what works in theatre and sound and music and who doesn't. The lighting person lighting your show, or the person doing operating the desk, who I respect these roles, they also may be a well-studied pianist or whatever. But I'm sorry, that's not what we're doing right now. I really respect what you're doing, but don't try and give feedback that's totally irrelevant, or collaborators that are sent to work with you. Your background is very formal, because I really respect what you're doing. Like I said, I actually studied the old plays so I could disregard them. I have done it. I've gone to uni. I've got my master's. I'm also a drama teacher. Am I allowed to disregard it now, or are you going to keep throwing it back in my face that you know better ways?
How do you perceive yourself in relation to the kids? You know, because like you have so many multiple potential roles in relation to them, like the mentoring role, the facilitator, the director, the teacher. What is your leadership philosophy, if you like?
I mean, it's hard, because I try and not be seen like the director. I try and seem like we're all doing this together. And really, that is how I like it to be like. Because although I've been on the planet longer, and, you know, I might know a few extra things, I want you to find your things as well. Not to know my things. I'm trying to get you to find your stuff. And sometimes maybe I'll have something that hopefully will be right and might help you out. The struggle is that to the outside world, they want you to act more of what they see as a director. And I guess, like, I don't know if this is valid for the conversation, but, you know, organizations and stuff will criticize my approach. But I'm like, but hold on, this has run for 12 years. No other program in the building has run for that long, and they don't have retention. But I don't try and be overbearing, or like, I just try and make it an honest kind of conversation. We're all trying to get there together. This is all of ours. I don't want it to just be my thing, but I definitely don't want it to be John's part, Tim's part, Rochelle's part either. Because all of our parts, I think the idea of, the reason why it maybe seemed like, not that I'm ranting, but I'm on this a slight path, is because Frankenstein's so successful, is that obviously there's lots of people that want to put their words in or get involved, because money gets involved. But the money's just going to come, we'll just deal with it. But don't alter the philosophy or the group, because it's not fair on all the other kids that we have coming along that need to have the same experience. You're going to ruin it. We all own it. I'm just, I'm in charge, I'm leading or whatever. That's just because it's good to have executive decisions. But I don't take it so serious. I am in a tricky situation where there's an expectation that with venues, with Edinburgh, the way that people speak to you. And it's like, look, if you want the show, which you do, you need to understand the art form, or at least just try to be willing to like work with me a little bit. And again, now we have people putting... The thing about ownership is that people talk about their points and their copyrights and stuff, but they're selling that to the performers. We've never had this problem before. And even in workshops, it's like, if this person gives a hi-hat and this person gives a kick drum, and the next person wants to give a hi-hat but doesn't because this part is very full and leaves space, we don't say that this person had a less. Leaving space is also writing. Knowing when not to make notes in music is just as powerful as making notes. Now, anyone that makes music knows that. But when it comes to maybe theatre people or just manipulative adults, they want to say, this person should get more money than everyone else because they're making more noise. But it's like, that person was only given license to make noise because we were all silent. And it's very, very difficult right now because of idiots, I have to say, because it's stupid to not understand that relationship. And I would say it's not even in music and sound, but in any company, theatre company or art, if we're painting a picture together, I'm going to put all these lines on. If your partner thinks, oh my God, this is brilliant, and it's just together, you both made it together. Because it takes that person sitting back and letting you do that. It was still a collaboration. But to think nervously, I'm going to put lines on too, so we both had lines, and you've ruined it now. What is the point of that? But these people, like, the more other people want to get involved, I'm like, you would ruin this. These people will never make shows because of their mentality.
Yeah. I just was thinking about the filmed version, which I was inevitably kind of comparing to the theatre version. And again, what's happened with the film is that it's medium specific. The way in which your adaptation of Frankenstein was medium specific to beatboxing and live performance, I was seeing kind of like some ways of acknowledging the influence of MTV on this particular way of rendering your show. Why did you want to make the film? What was behind that impulse?
I think the success of the show and having the opportunity to make a film is good. I think it makes the work more accessible for people to watch. I was hoping that it might inspire people, not beatboxing, but anything in the local community center with anyone of any age has some sort of fruits of the labor, even if that just means coming together. Now, I'm not sure how that comes across because of the part of the workshop parts at the end is very short. So I'm not fantastically happy with the film at all, because I feel that the film lends itself more towards the show part of it. Whereas to me, it needed to be more bookended, like what the show really is. I think as an entertaining music performance, All From The Mouth, it's very, it's interesting. I think people will enjoy it, but I don't think it has this, for me, it doesn't have the same effect as the live show. But why I'm happy about the show is because the kids get paid, they get exposure, but the art form gets exposure, and maybe more people can be encouraged to do stuff with young people, but people of all ages. And that's the spirit of hip-hop, is just creating something kind of nothing.
That's great. Thank you. For the end, I want to go back to your roots again. I was struck by what you said in Denmark about your grandma and the importance of oral history to her, the way in which she came alive when she was remembering her own experiences. And actually, certainly, I've really enjoyed listening to your stories. It's been a feature of this conversation too. I've heard everything you say about the importance of hip hop in kind of shaping your way of working and your aesthetic and your methodology. But is there a way in which you might connect this practice to something that has been a legacy, a cultural legacy for you, from your grandma or from any other people that came before you?
I guess the storytelling aspect is that they tell part and pass on, like, stories. And a lot of traumatic stories. If someone would tell a long story, and all of a sudden there might be a part in there, all of a sudden, of extreme abuse, and then bookend it with a joke. But you would never question the story, because right now it's story time. Someone's talking. It's not a conversation. So in a way, yeah, because stories are kind of a massive thing, and very detailed stories. In fact, I definitely don't go into the minutiae detail that my grandparents would go into. I mean, like, nonsensical, like, you know, 'cause I was sitting on the chair and the cup was on the side. Obviously, it was the cup that we got with the Easter egg last year. And it'd be like, I think, why do I need to know that part of the story? But it'll be that, and it's always been that way. Like, everything's very detailed. But also, that's because they don't read and write. So everything is super detailed because the stories have to be passed on. I need to record their stories because they're quite old, but because nothing's written down, and like there's barely any photographs. But definitely, I think the storytelling aspect of passing down those class-based stories
Thank you so much, Conrad.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.